Welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I'm your host, Amber, and I am here today with Anna Rose Johnson, author of The Star That Always Stays, which is a middle grade historical fiction, and the upcoming The Luminous Life of Lucy Landry. Welcome, Anna Rose.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited to talk about your first novel, which has won a whole bunch of awards: NPR Best Book of the Year, Junior Literary Guild Gold Standard Selection, and then you just won a Christie-related award this week. What was that one?
The Christie Amplify Award for Christian Fiction.
Oh, very cool. Congratulations. Are there any that I missed?
Well, thank you. Yeah. It also won a Michigan Notable Book Award. That was a very cool one.
That is special with your connection to Michigan. Well, one of the ways that we try to get to know our guests is through some of their favorite books. So do you mind sharing three of your favorite, most influential books with us? And then as a bonus, I know that you are a huge vintage children's books fan. And I was wondering if you could add just some recommendations of a few must reads that have a special place in your heart.
Yes, absolutely. So three of my favorite books, the ones that I usually say are my favorites, even though it's so hard to choose.
It is.
Would be Jane of Lantern Hill by Ellen Montgomery, and Little Women, obviously by Louisa May Alcott, and Emily of Deep Valley by Maud Hart Lovelace. And those three are some of just my all-time favorites. I love them so much. And they were not books that I read when I was, you know, a lot younger. I read them like in the last like 6 years. And I just love them and have returned to them over and over since then. So yeah, those three I love. And as far as books that are like very influential to me over the years, would be the Betsy Tacy series, also by Maud Hart Lovelace. I grew up reading those, and those were some of my very favorites as a child. And those have really been influential and inspirational to me as I write. The Star That Always Stays was inspired partially by the Betsy Tacy books. So yeah, other vintage children's books that I love would be, I love Noelle Stritfield, who wrote the Shoes books, Ballet Shoes and Dancing Shoes and Theater Shoes. And there are a bunch of others. I really love those as well. And then Elizabeth Enright, those books are amazing. I've read all of hers, even the one that is really hard to find. And so it would be like the Melindy Quartet books, beginning with The Saturdays, and then the Gone Away Lake series. Those are some of my very favorite vintage books.
I really liked her books when I was a kid as well, and I've been slowly collecting them for my kids, but I realized recently that we haven't read any of them because the collections aren't complete. And so I was thinking I should probably just get them on audio and just go through the audiobooks the next time we have some car rides lined up.
Yeah, they are really good on audio. I think
that's
I've
good
listened
to know.
All of them on audio. I really love audiobooks, and those in particular are some of the best ones that I've listened to.
Well, that's great to know. Thank you. So you said that the
Maud Hart Lovelace.
Okay, I couldn't remember what order her name went in all of a sudden. To put this in reference, I have been recovering from a mental burnout, and I actually called Jane Austen Jean Watson at the beginning of this year's podcast rounds. So We're making progress, but yes, remembering names is still a true struggle I'm having. So, Maud Hart Lovelace. Did I do that right?
Yep.
Yes, Maud Hart Lovelace, whose books I love. You said that those were part of the inspiration for The Star That Always Stays, but I also know that your own family story was part of the inspiration for that book. So what inspired you to delve into historical fiction, particularly centered around your own family's history?
Yes, so I always have liked historical fiction because I have always been interested in particularly the like turn of the century, Edwardian, World War I era. Even when I was a little girl, that was a big interest of mine. And so I always liked that time period a lot. And then when I was doing genealogy research about my great-grandmother, and then I started to learn more about her story, her childhood, and I realized that these big events that were happening in her life when her parents divorced and her mother remarried and she was starting high school and then World War I was starting in Europe. And so all these things were going on at the same time in 1914. And I realized that that could make a very interesting middle grade novel. And so because I had already, you know, been writing stories set in that general time period for a long time, it just seemed like a natural fit for me. And so yeah. I started, you know, doing the research and writing it. And yeah, it all came together really well. And yeah, I love the whole part of writing based on family history. And I think one of the reasons that I like that so much is because, again, it kind of ties in with the Betsy Tacy books, the fact that those were based on, you know, real people, right, and real her journal places. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I liked the time period being right before World War I because I think that you really did a great job capturing the innocence of the era of all these people who are just on the cusp of what we know are huge life changes and culture changes and global changes. And they have no idea. And they're hopefully and peacefully going about their lives. And I also thought it was really fun, especially knowing how much you love vintage books and we love vintage books, how you were able to incorporate into your main character's reading life so many books that were contemporary for her and vintage favorites for us. How did you pick? How did you pick which ones she was going to be reading?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely had to do some looking to make sure that they were actually, you know, had been published at that time. And I was sad that I had to not include, I think it was Anne of the Island and Pollyanna Grows Up, because those had been published just too late to be included in the book. So I had to take those out. But yeah, most of the ones I wanted to include did fit. So that was good.
That's good. Do you have a specific family story or anecdote that you can share that served as a seed for your historical fiction based on your genealogy?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, aside from the main story, like I was saying that, you know, these different things that I knew were going on in her life that became, you know, the main plot. But there's a story that Norvia's grandfather tells her, or that she remembers that he had told her at the beginning of the book. And that story of how her grandfather and his brother were delivering mail one winter to Beaver Island, and they fell through the ice, and, you know, people thought, you know, they gave them up for lost, essentially, and you know, it ended up being quite a big news story at the time. You know, even like New York Times was carrying the story that they were able to, you know, make it back. And they ended up, you know, staying in a lighthouse overnight. And then they were able to get back and they got $100 reward, I think. so, yeah, I was able to include a little bit of that story. in the book. So that was quite fun.
That's cool. That's a really special story to have. I love how people love genealogy and find things out, how there's all these interesting things that the people in the past have experienced and lived through. And then it's fun to just like tell those stories over and over again. My father-in-law recently discovered that one of his ancestors was put to death by one of the Queen Elizabeths as a heretic. Oh. And so now he just like throws that story in whenever he can. So that's just, I love that you were able to incorporate that story into a book and share it with another generation. So in writing this book, how did you find a good balance for you to staying true to the historical facts of your family story while also incorporating fictional elements for middle grade readers? And specifically, I found it highly interesting given the time period that we were dealing with, a family that had experienced divorce. And I thought that was handled really delicately and well. But even in that, how did you balance out your family's actual experience with the fictionalization aspect?
Mm-hmm. So actually, this is kind of the question that I get asked most often, like from other young writers. Sometimes they'll ask for advice on how to balance real family history with, you know, what the plot needs for a book. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like, how do you tell a good story structure wise and, you know, make it work? And when I was writing this book, I really tried to stay true to a lot of the main things about the family history. And so I wanted there to just be a lot of, what had actually happened. But I definitely had to make some changes just for the sake of making the book as good as it could be. Like for an example, Norvia had more extended relatives, in her day-to-day life, and it just got to be too many characters. I couldn't include everyone that I wanted to. But at one point in the process, someone had suggested getting rid of some of the main characters, like cutting down on how many siblings Norvia had. And that was just too big a change. I did not want to do that. That was too big. So I kept them all in. And and just other, smaller things I ended up having to change. But it's kind of a case-by-case thing, as writers drawing on family history, you're going to have to change some facts to make the book work. And you're going to have to keep a lot because they're, intrinsic to the story world. And it's hard to know like what to keep and what to take out. But I went based on what felt right to me. And so, it was challenging at times making those decisions. Mostly what I wanted to do in the book was just to, keep enough history to make it, to make sure that I was hitting the elements that I wanted to, for like the time period. But it was also trying to make sure that there was enough, of a balance of light going on as well, to counterbalance, the other aspects of the book, like the divorce and discrimination. And I wanted to, make sure that it stayed a really good, light enough story for young readers.
Yeah, I think it definitely maintained that nostalgic charm that one would expect from a vintage children's book. It really felt like it captured that. You just touched on the discrimination. Do you want to share a little bit about Norvia's heritage and why discrimination is something that's present in the book?
Yes. So, yeah, that was those elements of the book were not those were, you know, harder to know, you know, how to approach those, because I didn't, you know exactly how that played out in Norvia's real life. And so, yeah, basically what I had to do was try and, you know, present what, how I thought it could have been for her and her family. And
because, and so the cause is because her family is half Native American. Is that?
Yes, her mother is, yes, of Ojibwe descent. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so.
Which that is also very unique for that time period.
Yeah. And yeah. And it's, I think it's, and I was just saying this the other day. I was talking to a book club group, and I was saying how that really, to have Native American characters in a book set in this time period, 1910s, there really aren't that many books set in this like early 20th century that feature Native characters. You know, there's a lot of older books, you know, set in older time periods, and then contemporary books. And so it was cool to get to have a book, you know, kind of in that in between time.
Right. Yeah. I especially liked the fact that not like when we would see those characters in this time period, it would be them in their traditional tribal homes versus them married into a white family. Like, you don't often see the mixed marriages, and then them living in upper class settings. Mm-hmm. You definitely don't see that in children's books. And I think that that can be incredibly valuable representation.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so.
Because I mean, it's a true story. They were there. They were there. And so we should see them represented there in our children's books. Yeah. So did you find that while developing these characters based on real family members, that you had any challenge navigating the line between staying true to their essence and allowing for creative liberties? And did you have any pushback from your family in this process?
Yeah, as you know, like with the plotting, I tried to keep as much of, you know, the character's real life essence as I could. But if something needed to be a certain way for the book and it seemed important, then I, you know, would make those changes. But really, the more that I learned about Norvia and her family, the more that I realized some of the things were more accurate than I thought. Like with the character of Dicta, Norvia's younger sister, you know, I wrote her a very specific way. You know, she's very, you know, bubbly and, you know, says whatever is on her mind, and she's very funny. And the more that I learned about her, the more I realized that she really was like that. I got to look at her high school yearbook, and, you know, like there are jokes in the yearbook that she wrote. And so I was happy that I got her characterization pretty well, I think.
Yeah, that's very cool. So could you walk us through your research process from exploring and uncovering these details for your novels?
Yeah, the research process is one that it takes some time, and, you know, I spent a lot of time on it, but I really enjoy it. And, you know, a lot of the research that I did was just very typical genealogical research. You know, I was looking in old newspapers a lot, and you know, I would even write to different libraries, you know, to ask if they had the different materials that I wanted. And, you know, I would look at old magazines, and then even just the old books that I like reading were helpful to get a feel for, you know, the language of the time. And so, yeah, it was really just such a fun process. I love doing the research, you know, and I do genealogy research anyway, but then this was an added, you know, to find just the information that I wanted for the book, just right. added something extra to it. Yeah, it was a lot of specifically Michigan history research. And one of the things that I liked most in the research process was I asked family members if I could see different photos that I didn't have. And I ended up getting, you know, so many. And, you know, I was looking through a whole box of pictures that I got. And so then I used those to describe everyone and right. you know, the house. And so that was one of the best parts.
That's very cool. Has everyone responded positively in your family to this project?
Yeah, I've gotten some really, really nice comments on the book. I think that people really enjoyed it. It was just really nice to be able to connect with extended members of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And they very kindly shared stories and memories with me. And yeah, they really enjoyed the book and, you know, said how special it is. So I'm very grateful to have that support.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm so glad. How has delving into your family's history for your books influenced your own sense of personal identity and your connection to your roots? Because this is a big project and mm-hmm. very personal.
Yeah, very personal. And it's really done that tremendously. There is just such a nice sense of comfort, really, knowing that these stories, you know, get to live on in this book. I really, you know, appreciate that. And yeah, I feel very connected to Norvia, you know, throughout the writing of this process of writing the book.
Yeah.
And I think that I mentioned this on your Facebook group that when I was doing research on Norvia, I found out that her name on her birth certificate was actually Anna Norvia. And I just That's loved really having cool. that extra connection yeah. that I hadn't known about before. And yeah, that just added an extra layer to it.
You had to have gotten goosebumps when you discovered that.
That was pretty freaked cool. out.
That's very cool. In what ways do you hope that your books will foster empathy and understanding among young readers, especially regarding historical events in their proper historical place, not through modern eyes and the combination of family experiences?
Yeah, I hope that the book provides a bit of a, you know, window into a different time that young readers can, you know, find interesting. And I definitely hope that they, you know, really like the characters and emphasize with the struggles that they go through. Because I feel like a lot of the themes of the book are just very universal. Mm-hmm. You know, even though they're very specific to this context in history, you know, the how people, you know, viewed you know, divorced people and, mm-hmm. you know, Native Americans. And so, yeah, even though that's very specific to this, you know, this time, yeah, my hope is that young readers will empathize with it. I think that there can be a tendency to make characters, you know, very flawed nowadays. And with family stories, like a lot of times the siblings will argue a lot. And my yeah. hope in this story was to, you know, have a book where readers could connect with characters who, you know, may not always be perfect, but they have, mm-hmm. you know, these solid families and they really want to help each other. And yeah, mm-hmm. my hope is that young readers will really be able to connect with that.
Yeah, I know my kids did, so I'm sure.
I'm so glad.
I'm sure all the book awards you're winning and everything too are a good representation of the fact that this book really is connecting with readers, which makes me so happy.
Yeah, it's really special.
Yeah, it definitely is. How have you found ways to celebrate your successes with readers and then with the people in your circles?
Yeah, mostly how I like to celebrate, you know, wins with the book is usually involves ice cream.
Yeah.
That's a ritual I like.
Yeah, that's a good ritual.
Yep. Yeah, I like to do little things, with my family. Like a couple times we'll play a fun board game or something if, you know, something exciting happens. I like commemorating the things with just little fun events. And yeah, I try to, you know, share everything with my readers, like on my social media and email list. And yeah, I love keeping up with other writers, you know, successes with their books, and, you know, cheering on fellow writers. And it's really just wonderful when people do the same for me. It's just really, really nice.
Yeah, that is great to have the community like that. For our listeners, I want to say, if you have already read Ana Rosa's book, or if your children or you read it in the future, I highly recommend going to her Instagram page, which we will link in our show notes. And over the past year, I've seen a lot of times she's shared different photos of her family and little peeks into the characters' real lives that just adds another level of interest and excitement for people who have fallen in love with these characters. So we'll link to those, to your social media in general, but specifically to Instagram, for people to look at those pictures if they would like to later. So this has been a big project, and books don't happen on their own. So for this specific type of book especially, but just in general as well, how has your collaboration with editors and publishers and fellow authors all worked for you? Because I feel like the more authors I talk to, the more different it looks for all these different individual experiences. So what was your experience in getting this book written and then published?
Mm-hmm. It had a lot to do with getting really good feedback from a lot of different people. And yeah, it was a long process. I rewrote the book a lot of times, you know, like the first two drafts, you know, I completely got rid of, and then the third draft was starting all over again. And yeah, and for a long time I was mostly just working on it on my own, but then later on I realized how important it was to ask for critique and feedback from, you know, from other people, from writing mentors and fellow writers, and then later on hiring an editor, and then eventually getting to work with my agent and the editor at my publishing house. And, you know, over the years with so many different drafts and revisions, I came to see just how important that is to be able to accept critique from people, to not just, you know, brush off what people are advising, you know, because you want the book to be a certain way. Just being open to critique, that just made such a huge difference for me in this book. And so, yeah, the collaborative process with so many people has really made the book what it is, and it really would not be definitely would not be winning any awards without all of the great help that I've received.
Yeah, that's great. It takes a village, right?
Yes.
But I love hearing the level of humility that you are willing to exercise, and that really was so pivotal in this book becoming everything that you hoped it could be, and that it could be.
Yeah.
Are there other hidden gems in the world of vintage children's literature that maybe didn't make it into your book because they were written in the wrong time period, or that you didn't list earlier, that you think deserve more attention? I think there's a lot of good books that a lot of people do know about that have stayed in print or been preserved through different methods, like audiobooks and whatnot. But then there's some that just it feels like not a lot of people know about, and it makes my heart sad because like I wish people knew these books existed because they're so good.
Yes.
But harder to find. So then you feel bad recommending them to people because you know they aren't going to find a copy. Yep. But it's still something to look for, like those unicorns out there to keep your eye for when you're at book sales and whatnot. So do you have any hidden gems that you want to share?
Yeah, I do. And yeah, speaking of books that you wish you could recommend more widely, but no one can find them. Mine is, it's called Maggie Rose, Her Birthday Christmas by Ruth Sawyer. And I think I had mentioned that to you not that long ago. I love that book so much. It is beautifully written. It's from the 50s. And it's, to my knowledge, never been reprinted. I have a very old copy.
Yeah.
And it's just such a great Christmas story. And really about everyone in this town coming together to create this wonderful birthday Christmas celebration for this little girl who's trying so hard to, you know, make this happen. And it's just, it has just the sweetest ending. And I so wish that more people could read it just because I love it so much. So that's definitely one. Otherwise, I would say the Mitchells books by Hilda Van Stockham. Friendly Gables is the last one in the trilogy and is my personal favorite. And those have been reprinted. And I see them talked about, you know, a fair amount, but I don't think people have read them nearly as much as some of the
as it should be. Yeah.
Yeah, so I really wish that they would get more attention. And then another one that I almost never see getting recommended is From Anna by Jean Little, which is a big favorite of mine, and not just because the character has singing teeth. And it's a Canadian book, which I think is why it has never been as popular here. It's pretty popular in Canada. I think last year was its 50th anniversary, so it has been reprinted. Yeah, that is a really wonderful book, and I just reread it not that long ago. A little girl who comes to Canada from Germany in the 1930s, and she finds out how much she needs glasses, and that really, getting the glasses really transforms her life. And it's a fantastic book, and I'm recommending it all the time to people. So my hope is that it will become more popular again.
Yeah, I will jump on the Jean Little bandwagon. I also feel that people don't talk about her nearly enough. And I liked From Anna a lot when I was a kid as well, but I also loved Mine for Keeps.
Yes.
By Jean Little. And I think her books are so special. And she does such a good job capturing the emotional element of hard things, but not too hard, but just like the hard things that kids face, like immigration, needing glasses, wearing braces on your legs, making new friends, not speaking the same language as the people around you, having that challenge with connection. I think that's a key element in a lot of her books, is overcoming the things that divide us and finding ways to connect into communities. And that's really a special thing she does. And I wish people were reading her books more. Right there with you. Let's get on the bullhorn about this one, Anna Rose. We will just, we'll start a campaign.
Definitely.
One of the things that I really appreciated about The Star That Always Stays is that you were able to attack head on some big challenging issues that we see being written about today that are still issues today, such as discrimination and mixed families after remarriage. But you didn't fall into the whole of looking at it through modern sensibilities. And I feel that you were really able to look at it in a way that honored the time period that it was being written in, or the time period it was set in. And I think that probably has a lot to do with your love of children's vintage books and how many that you've read to be able to put yourself there. But I know that there's a lot of like specific themes from classic books that we don't see represented as much today. And I'm wondering if you consciously incorporate them into your own writing, or if it's just something that it feels natural because it's a part of you and you wouldn't even note that that isn't something that's present today as much as yesterday.
Yeah, I definitely think that my writing is very informed by the vintage books that I read so much. And yeah, I don't know if I would say that I consciously, you know, incorporate the kinds of themes that are in vintage books. Although I think that, yeah, it's just so much a part of how I write that it comes very naturally, you know, and even in just like the actual writing of my books, I feel mm-hmm. like the vintage style has become really embedded in how I write. And, you know, I've had people say that the dialogue in The Star That Always Stays is very authentic to the time period. And I think that is because I'm so steeped in the the vintage style. And I would say on themes, I really love like the found family themes that are in vintage mm-hmm. children's books. And it's something I explore more in my upcoming Lucy book. There are a lot of vintage books where kids, you know, find a place in a family, a lot of time orphans. And I think that's a really wonderful theme. And yeah, I loved including that in Lucy. And I was definitely thinking of some vintage books that have those themes when I was writing it.
Yeah. So The Luminous Life of Lucy Landry, that's your upcoming book. Does that one have a release date?
Yes. That one comes out on March 5th next year.
Awesome. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yes. So it's the story of an orphan girl named Lucy Landry, and she goes to live with a family who lives in a lighthouse. Their father is a lighthouse keeper on Lake Superior, and there's a bit of a mystery involved with searching for some treasure. And yeah, I really enjoyed the mystery aspect of it. That was fun to write something a little different than The Star That Always Stays. So I really hope that people like it.
Yeah, that's super exciting. I'm very much looking forward to reading it. What is the time period?
This one's set in 1912, so the same time.
yeah, that same period. Very cool. So with all the books that you read currently, are there any contemporary authors or books that you've read that you believe will become the vintage classics of the future?
I would definitely say the Penderwix series by Jeannie Birdsall. I feel like those are already sort of, you know, have become classics in a way. Yeah, I definitely think people will still be reading those, you know, 100 years from now. I also love the Vanderbeekers books by Karina Yan Glazer. I think that those really have a lot of that same feel as the vintage mm-hmm. books. But yeah, one book I haven't seen talked about as much that was written a few years ago is Rosetown by Cynthia Rylant. And that one I feel like really has the potential to become a classic in the future, you know, if more people find it, because it's just such a wonderful story. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed all of those. And I think those have definite classic potential.
I agree. I really appreciated A Place to Hang the Moon. I feel like that has the potential to be a future classic. I read Rosetown. I don't know why people haven't read it. And I think it's interesting that you brought that one up, because it also deals with a family separation mm-hmm. situation. And we don't see that often enough. I think in my experience growing up in a Christian family, surrounded by a bunch of Christian families, the way it was always talked about was that we didn't want to glorify divorce by reading stories about it. But I think that that is really faulty thinking. I don't think that it glorifies it to acknowledge that it exists. And I think that by never talking about it, we do our children a disservice of not knowing when it's appropriate and necessary. And that these types of books can also really build empathy, because even if our children are in a situation where they don't have to go through divorce, statistically, their friends, at least some of them, will go through divorce. And I think that Rylant's book really handles that emotional aspect very well of seeing the child going through the separation and having a really good friend able to be by their side and talk them through it and be that support, which I think on the empathy aspect can show you, like, model how to be that empathetic person who is a solid rock in the situation for someone going through choppy waters. So I'm glad that you mentioned that book because it's really stuck with me since I read it, and Inara read it as well last year. So when she was 15, and she brought that up. She's like, yeah, you know, we don't have a lot of books that have divorce in them. And I think that it's something that's important to understand more about. And I thought that was a good observation from her.
Yeah, I thought that that book was just really, really well written, and yeah, dealt with it very, very gently. And yeah, I just loved it.
Yeah, it's a good one. That will be in our show notes with all these other books that we have talked about as well. And I just like to talk to people who love old books about read-alouds, because vintage books are very often celebrated for being really suitable to read-alouds in a way that sometimes modern books aren't, just in sentence structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always like one of the first things I do when I'm reading a new book is I will read a paragraph aloud just to myself to see what the mouth feel is, because mm-hmm. it's such a different thing. And so I'm wondering, are you someone who still reads aloud with people in your life? I know often when we reach adulthood, it's harder to find the people who are willing to do that with us. But mm-hmm. is that still part of your culture?
Yeah, so I don't read aloud a lot because my voice tends to give out pretty fast when I'm reading mm-hmm. aloud. Like, I'm good for maybe 10 minutes. But yeah, I read the original Madeline picture book to my cousin a lot of times. She really loved that one. And what I found in reading a lot of different picture books to her is that I don't love it when picture books are like very repetitious. Like, I find that hard to keep up the reading aloud on those. But book like Madeline, where yeah, it's in rhyme and it's very fun. And yeah, mm-hmm. that's one that you can read aloud over and over again. Yeah, they're just certain books have that read aloud quality, I think, more so than others. But yeah, I've been able to find a lot of really good read aloud picture books. And like the Ramona books are good read alouds too.
Yeah.
There's just so many great scenes. And a book like that is good for a read aloud because it works in reading in small chunks
mm-hmm.
because it's so episodic, you know, yeah. as opposed to, you know, a more sweeping narrative across the whole
right.
book.
Right. That's funny that you bring up Ramona, because I've been talking with Inara, because she's my eldest, about Ramona a lot lately, because when she and my second oldest, who's 14 now, Gemma, when they were little, we listened to all the Ramona books on audiobooks. So they're very familiar with the story and they really liked them. I have 5 kids, and my first 4 were not children who would reenact things that they read in books.
Okay.
And then my 5th came along, and she is 5 and she is Ramona. And I really want to like read Ramona with her because I think they're kindred spirits. But at the same time, I'm like, this kid gets herself into more than enough trouble just from her own imagination. And I don't feel like I have a good measuring stick in her life so far as to whether or not she will take terrible things that Ramona does and do them herself.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, man, I really need to find something like that isn't a huge threat to the sanity of our family to be like, hey, isn't this a funny thing this kid did, but let's not do it and see yeah. if she does it or not, because I do not want to open a can of worms by giving her Ramona and just seeing her own Ramona-ness
yeah.
just amplified. But I'm like, oh my goodness, if nothing else, I'll give them to her when she's an adult and be like, read this. This is your childhood. It's basically your memoirs. And yeah, I love the older sister aspect in Ramona as well mm-hmm. with Beezus, because my youngest, Lily, she's great friends with everybody, but she and Gemma have a really special relationship. So that age difference is there of like mm-hmm. the 5 to 14 with them. And the two of them really do remind me a lot of Ramona and Beezus. And Gemma's just so much calmer and chiller and saner. And then Leora is just a full handful of nuts. So
yeah, I love that.
Oh, man. Well, thank you so much for sharing about these books with us. And I'm really looking forward to The Luminous Life of Lucy Landry releasing in March. And people can get their hands on The Star That Always Stays already. And our closing question that we use is, what is something that you do for self-care? Because we talk a lot about wintering seasons and how everyone goes through them. And I think that it's just one way that we can make it not feel so lonely when we're in them, to realize everybody goes through them at some point or another, and everybody has a different way that they face it. And so what is something that you have done for self-care, or even just if you are like, you know, life has been cyclical, but I don't really feel that I've been in a true wintering stage, just something that you've seen modeled for you by someone else mm-hmm. works as well.
Yeah, I would say probably one of the things I like most to do along those lines is I like knitting, and mm-hmm. I like knitting like in front of a very fun TV show or movie. Yeah, just that little, you know, quiet time doing those activities. I like that a lot. Last winter I worked on a knitted quilt that wasn't big, but it took me a long time. I worked on it from the first day of autumn to the first day of spring. And yeah, during that time I watched through the Road to Avonlea TV series while I worked on it every night. And I really liked that. That was it's such a calm activity.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never gotten better at knitting than just knitting like a really long row, but I enjoy that. I can yeah. take it out and do it all over again with the same piece of yarn.
Yeah.
But there's someone in our Facebook group who's been doing the coolest thing the last 2 years. She's been knitting a blanket in squares, like doing the like knitted squares, and she's doing it based on what she's reading. And so she assigned at the beginning of making this quilt a different color to each genre. And then for each book okay. she finishes, she makes a square for that genre and just attaches it to the blanket. And she's making all these rows, and it's like her own little really bookshelf. Cool. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And that's been fun to follow on Instagram, like her stack of books and then her stack mm-hmm. of squares next to it is pretty
neat. Yeah, that's really fun.
So, yeah, I think that she got the inspiration from those weather blankets that people do, where like mm-hmm. the temperature blankets. And I thought this was a fun way to make it yeah. fit what she was interested in. So, well, thank you so much, Ana Rose, for coming and sharing with us. This was so interesting and fun. And everyone, all of these books will be in the show notes and linked so that you can find them. And then when you read them, or if you have already read them, please jump over to Amazon or Goodreads and leave a review, because those are so important to our authors and help them to continue doing what they do. And so we will talk to you all next time. And remember, the stories are truer than true.